Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to AnCast. Welcome to our holiday special. This is the first in a series of two shows. Welcome, Justin. Thanks for doing this again.
Always happy to. It's a marathon.
Yeah, last year we did our decade in review, and so this year the plan is to run down our top 10 best anime, bottom 10 worst anime, and we're going to do the same for movies because we're movie nerds. I think everyone listening knows that. We should lay down some ground rules before we get into this, because getting into any kind of a top 10 situation is always tricky. And you're always going to have people going, questioning your choices based on some list of arbitrary rules that they put in place for a top 10.
Right.
I think the best way to describe it is these are our top 10 personal favorites. Not what we objectively feel are the best ever made, but subjectively our favorites.
Right. We haven't seen everything. Sometimes some very noteworthy stuff we've missed over the years.
Well, and I'm willing to admit that there's stuff on my list that, of course, Citizen Kane is a better movie than, most of the stuff on my top, all the stuff on my top 10 movies. But I wouldn't put it on my top 10 personal favorite because I've seen it twice and I don't ever need to see it again, So it's kind of a personal favorite, personal worst situation. The other thing that's important with the worsts is that we are not reaching into the terrible B movie or so bad it's good. Well, we're staying away from that, which actually made the worst anime list really, really difficult.
Oh my God. All of the old go-tos were, we couldn't use them.
Well, we really wanted to stay away from so bad it's good, which is Madball, which is Violence Jack, which is all that cheesy stuff from the 80s and, the 90s that we watch for fun. Like, Garzy's Wing is not on these lists. Because you would put that in any time. For movies, I stayed far away from Mystery Science Theater, anything that's ever been on MST, stuff like The Room. Those things they don't really count to me. It has to be a movie that was theatrically screened, had a budget, people were trying really hard, there was craft services involved, real theatrical movies where they were made a sincere effort, not Manos the Hands of Fate, not Pod People, not any of that sort of thing. So I stayed far away from that. I'm pretty sure you did too.
Yeah. All of mine, you could argue that some of them people weren't trying, but let's face it, nobody sets out to make a bad movie. So, I tried to be respectful with the ones that, people were clearly working really hard, but just had such a wrong-headed idea of what to do when making the film that it just ended up just completely blowing up in their faces.
The way I kind of see it is, if I were to have a top 10 ugliest people and just load it up with circus freaks, I wouldn't want to do that, because of course the circus freaks are hideous. That's why they're circus freaks. You don't put them in there. You pick,
right.
You
want to list the ugliest personalities.
Yeah, there you go. And I think that's in the spirit of what we're doing here. So that's why when we list our top 10 worst, there's no really obvious, Mystery Science Theater type stuff on there. Okay, so without further ado, we should go ahead and get started here. So in this first episode, we're going to do our top 10 best anime and the top 10 and our bottom 10 worst movies. So these will sort of mirror each other. That way we'll have a mix of positive and negative in both episodes. I think that's sort of important, so it's not just huge downer and then huge upper, One can only take so much negativity around the holidays.
Yeah, and we're also with our families.
So. There you go. Okay, dude, so let's get started here. So first up, we're starting from the bottom. So this will be number 10. So your number 10 favorite anime of all time.
My number 10 favorite anime is Kite.
Kite, really interesting. That was on a lot of lists.
Yeah, and I have to be very specific here. Only the dub,
mm-hmm.
and only the R-rated Kite.
Right, not the one where they added in all the kiddie porn.
Well, added in was originally there, whatever you want to call it.
Didn't they force him to go edit, put all that shit back in?
Well, it was made like that, and then Media Blasters cut it out for the U.S. release because the animation was so good and there was clearly so much more there. And then the director was like, well, yeah, that's what I wanted to do anyway, but I had to make it porn to get funding. So then they released an international version with Media Blaster's dub and, you know, mostly their cut to Japan. And then Media Blaster's re-released that here like 10 years later. And yeah, the release is kind of a mess. But as long as you get the R-rated cut, I'd say you're golden.
And the dub is really good.
The dub is actually the only dub, possibly in anime history, that adds significantly more emotional gravitas to the show.
Really?
The original Japanese was very, you know, very typical voice actory, you know, just standard anime voices. The dub, which was by Coastal Recording, you know, Scott Houle, he got a very fragile female voice to play the lead protagonist, Sawa, who's, you know, this utterly broken girl who's just, you know, been subjected to years of abuse, and really gave her this very moving emotional fragility. And that just completely forced a complete rethinking of the entire emotion behind the story. And it really kind of changed a lot. Even though the script was almost verbatim the Japanese.
Interesting. Now, is this, can you still buy this? Is it floating around out there? You can still get it?
Okay. Yeah, it's still in print. The original DVD looks like ass, so, but the new one, the cut, they tried to smooth over some of the edits they made earlier, and it doesn't work quite as well, I don't think, but hey, you know what? It looks decent. And, of course, warning for the kiddies, it is really, really violent. I think it really kind of, it's an artistic kind of violence. It's so over the top that it almost becomes satire of violence. It's almost, it kind of goes beyond any sort of realistic and just kind of goes into just complete grand guignol from the get-go.
Yikes. Yeah, I mean, I've seen Kite. It was years and years and years ago, but I do remember enjoying it. And it really does, it is pretty spectacularly animated. Really nice.
Oh, just beautiful. Yasuo Miyamatsu at the top of his game. It's too bad Kite Liberator didn't really, it wasn't all that good.
Yeah, or the TV series.
Well, that was Mezzo.
Right, yeah. Same sort of thing.
It's too bad everything Yasuo Miyamatsu has made since has kind of sucked.
You're right. All right. Okay, so my number 10 favorite anime of all time, I was surprised this is here, but I picked Baccano.
Really?
Yeah, actually, I've watched it twice since we started talking about it on the show last year. And it's probably the most recent thing on my list. I really enjoyed the hell out of that show.
It is really good.
It's really good. Like, it's really exciting. It's really well written. I love the characters. Like, just love the characters. It's really stylish. I love the setting. I have to admit, I'm not a huge fan of the dub just because I don't really like all the on-the-nose period dialogue and period slang.
Right.
Kind of throws me off. I've always been kind of thrown off by that. Like, Martin Scorsese has a real problem with the throwing in too much period slang.
Whenever, use mugs.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, Gangs of New York, Boardwalk Empire, both have real problem with that. And the dub of Baccano, I would say, is similar. But in Japanese, I think the show's just delightful. And it's the most recent show that I've watched multiple times.
It's astonishingly graceful at how it weaves all these bizarrely interconnected story threads.
Yeah, and you know, people say they were disappointed by the ending, but I was okay with it. And to the point where I thought some of the OVA episodes that they added onto the end were kind of extraneous and not totally necessary. I enjoyed them, but I didn't think they were 100% necessary. I was okay with it.
It is a really good show. It totally recommended for me as well.
Yeah, and again, I'm surprised it was on here. And I should point out, making this top 10 list was difficult. There are at least 4 or 5 number 11s that I would have put on here. Baccano beat out One Piece, Berserk, stuff that belongs on this list, but I don't know. It's, you know, thinking back to it, I enjoyed the experience of watching that show is very enjoyable. So definitely goes on there. Okay, and then with every number, what I did is I asked everybody out there to send in their top threes for all these categories. Now the response I got was overwhelming. I got a ton of lists, so I'm not going to be able to get to all of them. But at the end of each number, I will read somebody's category. So first up here, top three anime from the King of Hearts, a listener and forums user. His top three anime, Canon 2006, Gurren Lagann, and Kite, your number 10. So there you go. I don't know about Canon, but... I almost put Gurren Lagann on there, but then I said, no. I haven't really.
I definitely see the appeal in Canon. I just... It didn't click with me. Maybe I'm just too old and cynical.
Maybe. I don't know. Okay, so number nine. You're number nine.
My number nine is My Only Miyazaki. And actually, I think my only... No, it's not my only Ghibli on my list, but Princess Mononoke.
Interesting. Okay.
By far my favorite Miyazaki film. His most adult work, I think, is probably the only one that's pretty much outright for adults. Maybe Porco Rosso. But there are just... moments in Princess Mononoke that still, 15 years later, just take my breath away. The initial confrontation between San and Ashitaka as he's trying to leave the city, and his big cursed wound is starting to attack and freak San out. Just some truly unforgettable imagery and really, really compelling stories. Yes, the message is pure, heavy-handed, Miyazaki, save the Earth. But you know what? That's fine. Somebody needs to say it. And it's easily his best of his very, very good, but let's face it, somewhat overhyped canon.
You know, I'm a little surprised that that's the only Miyazaki on your list, and it's that far down. I'm curious now to know what the rest of your list is, but yeah, that's I don't know. I mean, I rewatched Prince in the course of doing the quote unquote research for these, for you know, compiling these lists. I rewatched Mononoke, and it's not on my list, but it is a spectacular film, and I'm kind of surprised. You know, having rewatched that and Spirited Away, Mononoke was the one I think that deserved the best picture or the best animated feature Oscar. I would absolutely give it to Mononoke.
It was the last Miyazaki movie with a point.
That is true.
it was everything after that has been, well, here's a bunch of stuff that happens.
How whimsical and delightful, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really pretty, but what?
Yeah.
So what was your number nine?
My number nine is Porco Rosso.
It's Miyazaki time.
Yeah, not the only Miyazaki on my list, but... couldn't have a number a top 10 without it. Just pure entertainment, start to finish. Like, really, really well made. And it's a very personal film for him. Like, I understand the Porco character is Miyazaki. It's a thinly veiled version of himself, I think. It's pretty easy to point out. But I love the setting, and the action's really good, and the characters are great. And it's unassuming, and I think of his films, it's probably the most just... face-forward entertaining.
Absolutely. I love Porco Rosso.
Right.
Did you catch the Roald Dahl reference in there?
Yes, I did catch that.
I'm not sure how many of our listeners were Roald Dahl fans. We're getting a little long in the tooth, so I'm not sure if kids even still read Roald Dahl these days.
Well, they're still adapting his books every now and then,
I suppose. But it's just kind of this pure sense of heavy with the world, but still has a sense of whimsy to it.
That's true. Miyazaki's obsession with flying machines is a little sometimes oppressive in some of his movies. It's like, okay, airships, got it. this was the one where the flight sequences and stuff are... it's clear that a lot of love was put into them, but they don't weigh the movie down. They're not intrusive. It doesn't feel like it overtakes the film. So it's kind of a delicate balance. I don't know. It's just a great movie.
What do you think of that French musical sequence?
I like it. Actually, although I am an absolute sucker for anything sung in French for some reason. So
I don't know. Have you heard some French pop music?
No. But anything where it's like you can hear the record scratches and you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. I'm a total sucker for it. So I love it in Porco Rosso. It's awesome.
It was just such a great mood setter. And I've heard a lot of people complain about it. And I think those people are really missing something.
I think you have to be a little bit of a romantic to enjoy that kind of thing. Yeah. And if you're not, then that's not really going to appeal to you very much.
That's true.
At all. Okay, so Let's go ahead and get to the next reader top three from I Kill Chicken. His top three anime series: Cowboy Bebop, Evangelion, Trigun. Pretty standard choices.
For a Western thing. Unusual to have Trigun on top.
Sorry, I'm going 1, 2, 3.
Oh, okay.
Bebop number one, number two Evangelion, number three Trigun.
Okay, that makes more sense to me.
Bebop was one of the ones I didn't put on my list, and it probably would have been number 11, like five or six other shows, but didn't make it on there.
It didn't make it on my list either, and it probably would have had I been, you know, a more fun person.
Right. Well, the show's really good, but admittedly, it doesn't leave much of a lasting impression in terms of this is a work of art that I feel is vital.
Right. It's not something you revisit when you're in a mood.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the movie more than I've seen the show. I think it's just because the movie is one compact sort of adventure. I get my fix of those characters in that one sitting, and I don't have to sit through 26 episodes. It's just the one thing.
There's a couple really great episodes I love revisiting, though.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's definitely, like, it's a must-have show. Any anime fan needs to see it. For some reason, it didn't make it onto my top 10.
Right.
Okay. All right, number 8. You're number 8.
My number 8, the original movie of Ghost in the Shell.
Ghost in the Shell. Okay.
Not 2.0. Not 2.0. Not Innocence. Way the fuck not Innocence.
Not the orange version.
and not any of the TV series. Although I like the TV series. I don't love them. But the original Ghost in the Shell was just such a mind-blowing mood piece that still really holds up today. It's thoughtful, but not oppressively thoughtful. And it has some of the Oshii's best work, honestly, and his composer Kenji Kawai just come together to create this mood of urban decay and the sense of unease as to, like, what have we become and what are we turning ourselves into. It's thoughtful in that way, and yet still has some really great action set pieces. Honestly, it's a movie that I can just pop in any time and just kind of lose myself in, no matter what mood I'm in.
Yeah, that's, you know, there's a reason that that one became accessible, or was accessed, I guess, by a lot of film critics. The public at large seems to know what it is. It was one of the breakout titles for a reason. It is a cool, relatively accessible film, I would say. It's not too ponderous. It doesn't... Right. It doesn't leap into the the navel-gazing wormhole that Innocence does. But no, it's a really solid movie, even today. It's a really great piece. I bought that Blu-ray, the 2.0 or whatever, and it's a shame about the transfer of the original.
Yeah, and it's I wasn't even a fan that... I will never watch 2.0 again. I'm glad I have it. I'm glad it's in my library, but I don't think it's ever going to see the light of the laser in my Blu-ray player again.
Yeah, well, they really kind of fucked it up.
They really did.
It just didn't work.
Yeah, I wish they'd bring out the original movie on Blu-ray here, but we'll have to make do with an import.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the legacy of that show, of that movie, is, like we were talking about, a long and winding series of spin-offs. None of which I think ever recaptured what was so good about the original. Like you said, you can pop that in pretty much any time and get lost in it. And most of the rest, it's a little bit of a slog.
It really is. In varying degrees.
Yeah. Hmm. All right.
So what's your number 8?
My number 8 is Interstellar 5555. The Daft Punk Leiji Matsumoto collaboration.
I knew that was going to be on your list.
It wasn't until the last minute.
Really?
When I remembered it, yeah. Yeah. This popped it. I've probably seen this like 20 times, I want to say. It is intensely watchable and to me represents the apex of when anime was cool, why anime was cool, and what makes anime so cool. Great, great visuals. I mean, that Daft Punk album is, in my opinion, one of the best albums of all time. Discovery, amazing album. And the music videos are really, really, really good. It tells a pretty simple little story about an alien band being exploited by an American producer. And I just fucking love it. It's so good. Like, it's so cool. It came out at a time when people still thought anime could be really awesome and cutting edge and hip and something you could show in a club. and not get laughed at. And there hasn't been anything like it since. That's for sure.
That's true. I wasn't a big fan of this just because Daft Punk... I'm an electronica fan, and Daft Punk makes me want to cut myself like a 16-year-old girl.
Really?
But at the same time, this is so cool that I will still watch it.
Right. It's increasingly difficult to find. Like, it's not an easy DVD to track down. But if you can find it, it's out there. It's only about 70 minutes, you know, the length of the album. And it's a little bit of a trifle in terms of, you know, having any sort of depth. But it really does represent a time and a place for the medium that had sort of infinite possibilities. And unfortunately, that's not where we went. But it's a reminder of
time. Did Leiji Matsumoto do anything on it other than character design?
No, I'm not 100% convinced that he really... Because the character designs are so... They could have just copy-pasted them from any freaking Galaxy Express. Leiji Matsumoto character designs, let's face it, they're all kind of the same.
Yeah, he has three templates.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay, so let's see here. From Egoist forum user, his top three anime. Number one, Darker Than Black. The number two, Higurashi. And number three, One Piece. That's a diverse list.
Wow.
I've never seen Darker Than Black. Did you ever sit through that?
I saw an episode. It didn't really click with me, but I got the feeling I might be too old for it.
Maybe, yeah. Well, this guy totally loves it. So there you go. Higurashi, I think, is probably one we're going to see on some other lists here. Definitely seems to be popular.
Yeah, that I've never seen, and that I probably should.
Yeah, I still have one of the box sets. Funimation re-released it a couple times, I think.
Right.
And so I've got one of them sitting here, and I mean to get to it. I will get to it someday, but not this time. Okay, your number seven.
My number seven. This will surprise absolutely no one. Please Save My Earth.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The OVA based on the really, really long-running manga.
Right. Manga's 21 volumes. The OVA only really covers the first two or three books. Jumps around a little. But this was probably the first shoujo I ever saw. And, man, nothing has measured up since. It's just such an indelibly, it's so romantic and so nostalgic. It's really kind of, God, how can I even explain this? It's just kind of perfect in its own way. Even though the OVA leaves off at kind of a cliffhanger, it goes into places where it develops the characters so well it almost doesn't matter. Now, obviously, now that the manga's out in print, and probably out of print by now, but can be had in the used market, you can pick up where it left off in the books. But taken as a whole with the manga and the anime, it's just kind of, to me, one of the perfect seminal works of anime and manga.
Yeah. It's a little slow, I thought. But I think that's part of that's an obviously intentional. I don't know.
Really? I thought it moved kind of fast. But.
Well, I was never particularly gripped by the story of Please Save My Earth, so that's probably why I thought it was a little slow. I think if you're more familiar with the comics, maybe it means a little bit more. I don't know. Did you read the comics first, or did you see the anime first?
I didn't read the comics until like a decade later.
Wow, okay. Interesting. You can't really get this thing anywhere, can you?
Well, the Viz DVD is still floating around used.
Okay, so you can still get it.
Can't be too hard to find. There is actually a really, really nice looking Korean edition that's very cheap and has the English subs from the Viz release.
Do you think they'll ever revisit Please Save My Earth? Like in terms
I wish they would. Actually, Please Save My Earth is a show that I think would be perfect for Hollywood adaptation into a TV series.
You think so?
Yeah, because it has a supernatural element. It's about young people, but as young people. It would kind of work on the WB, I think. Yeah, the supernatural kind of, you know, Smallville sort of audience, I think, might go for it with a few tweaks here and there.
So sort of a teenage, maybe middle-aged sci-fi fan might dig it. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. And what's your number seven?
Escaflowne TV. Obvious choice.
Nice.
I'm surprised it's as low on the list as it is. I thought it would be higher, but I rewatched it. You know, what makes Escaflowne so good, and you can distill it down to, I think, just this. The narrative is so solid and so well written and so well paced those episodes, and I forgot about this, every episode ends in a cliffhanger.
Wow.
Where you cannot not want to see the next one. And I remember that, because I saw this show, we watched it week to week, you know, somebody would get the next tape in, and people would savor the episodes back during my anime club days, like it was a fresh, you know, a fresh shipment of heroin or whatever. but those cliffhangers are really, they really grab you. You really want to see the next episode. And while the narrative itself, it's decent high fantasy. It's nothing.
It's composite board.
Yeah, exactly. But it's just really well. It's just really well put together. There's a lot to say for something that, while it might not have anything totally groundbreaking or innovative in it, a really good story told really well, there's no substitute for it. And that's kind of what Escaflowne is, and that's sort of why it endures. I think it's just one of the best-written fantasy TV shows I've ever seen, top to bottom. It's really good.
Yeah, it's really, really well-paced, which is something that anime tends to completely fall down on.
Yeah, and for 26 episodes, they don't really waste any time.
There's no filler.
Yeah, there's no filler. None of it feels rushed. All the characters get plenty of screen time. By the end of it, I cared about everybody. Mm-hmm. Except for Alan Shazer. I don't know why. I don't like that guy, but I think it's his hair. But yeah.
It's a very 90s look, that.
It is a very 90s look, and it's got those character designs from, I'm blanking on the guy's name. They've got those really exaggerated noses, which works in terms of, because the show's very angular to begin with.
Yes.
And the character designs really work in that, in context, they work quite well. I also rewatched the movie, which I actually like the movie. I like the movie plenty, actually. I really didn't have a problem with it. It was an interesting reinterpretation of the story.
Yeah, it's a trifle, but it's a really pretty trifle.
The soundtrack is much better than the film.
Yes.
For sure.
But hell, the soundtrack to the whole thing is just, it's one of the great seminal soundtracks in anime history.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Okay.
God, I can't listen to that until the end of time, really.
Yeah, really. Okay, so Robbie Nicomimi's top three anime. Number one, Planetace. Number two, Interstellar. And number three, Hajime no Ippo.
Ooh, good choices all.
Yeah, good choices. I have never finished Planetace, but I hear I should.
I love Planetace. It's not the most, it's not crack like the best of anime series, but it's really compelling. I kind of equate it to an updated Pat Labor, which probably doesn't help anybody.
Yeah,
it's just a really compelling tale of a working man in a sci-fi setting, and I think that in and of itself is cool and somewhat unique enough in the world of anime and the world of sci-fi that it kind of stands on its own.
Yeah, I was watching that as Bandai was putting the singles out, and I don't think I ever got like number four or something, so I never saw the rest of it.
Oh yeah, that'll kill you.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I'll go to a book off and hunt them down, if you can even still, that one's got to be way out of print.
Planetus, actually no, you can get it, I think you can still get it in one of those really, really cheap, all of the discs in one little case thingy.
Oh, maybe I'll track it down.
Yeah. Hajime no Ippo, however, Fighting Spirit, that's way out of print.
Yeah.
And no one's bringing that one back.
No, God.
I love that show. I think it was the first show I watched during the day after I started working for ANN, and I was like, wow, I can just watch stuff during the day and get my work done at night. This is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I just ended up marathoning all 76 odd episodes in like the space of a week or two.
Yeah, you talked about this before, described yourself as a crying heap at the end of it all.
Yeah.
Surrounded by discs like some horrible addict.
Oh, those were the days.
Okay, number six.
Number six, the only Shonen Jump series on my list, Hikaru no Go.
Really?
Yeah. What I thought was going to be the most boring show ever became really, really fun to watch. Then about halfway to two-thirds of the way through, it takes a somewhat unexpected turn and becomes one of the most moving shows I've ever seen.
Now, I think that was the case for a lot of people, because Hikaru no Go was really popular in its day.
Right.
I didn't know really, I didn't have any close friends who were anime fans that weren't watching that show. And the controversial thing about it is what you mentioned, where it takes a sort of hard right turn.
Mm-hmm.
And ditches ditches the supernatural element of the show entirely, right?
Well, it acknowledges that it's there, but it's not... it does cast a pall over the previous two-thirds of the show as to, you know, what exactly it was. Was it part of the main character's imagination? Was it, you know, something that... It almost doesn't matter whether or not that character was imagined. What it really becomes about is the emotional journey that the main character has to go through, that Hikaru has to go through as a result. And that is indescribably compelling.
You know, that's a pretty tough trick for a show to pull off.
It really does.
And not feel forced or badly done.
And it works perfectly. And the last episode of Hikaru no Go is complete waterworks. Like, yeah. If you've been following the show and if you love the characters, I defy you to get through it without sobbing.
Wow.
It is just indescribably powerful stuff. Way, way, way beyond what I think any Shonen Jump series before or since has ever been able to do, I think.
Now, I know the comics have a different ending from what I've been told.
It emphasizes that transformation a little differently. What happened is they tried to go beyond where the natural end was, and then they just, after a few chapters, they went, you know what, this isn't working, bye guys, the end.
So not quite as deftly pulled off.
Right. So they ended it at the natural place to end it in the anime series, and then that one half-finished arc they made into a feature-length special later.
Right. But from what I understand, most people were pretty satisfied with that TV ending.
There's nowhere for it to really go from there. I mean, what are you going to do? Follow the kid throughout his entire life?
Yeah. Well, Hikaru no Go. Interesting. I did not expect that to be on your list.
I didn't either, and it wasn't on my first drafts. And then I was just like, oh yeah, wow, that made a huge impact on me. And then, all right. So what's your number six?
Perfect Blue.
Nice.
Actually, the only cone on my list. I expected there to be more, but Perfect Blue is his most entertaining film, in my opinion, his most exciting film, and I think Millennium Actress is a better movie, but Perfect Blue to me is just more like I can watch that once a year and not have any issue with it. I think it's just really, really, really good and really, really, really well made. And representative of what was to come for him. Now, everybody's been talking nonstop about Khan since he passed away, so right. I don't really want to belabor the point. It's obvious why this is on my list. It's obvious why it's, you know, as high as it is. I think, for me personally, when I look at his work, that's the one I would pick. Is like, okay, if I want to sit anyone down and say, here's what this director could do, I would probably put Perfect Blue in.
There are scenes in Perfect Blue that are just so rousing. You just can't help but it becomes part of your mental vocabulary.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, for example, one of my personal favorites, the overdriving, distorting boombox in the elevator.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of... it's really unsettling. It's really creepy. And not only that, I think Perfect Blue is a great example of a movie I would feel extremely confident showing somebody who's never seen anime before and be confident that they would be entertained and creeped out and get everything out of it that they would out of a live action movie.
Man, that acted rape scene is really hard to take for a lot of people though.
Yeah, you're right on that one. Okay. I wouldn't show it to my mom, but someone who is a movie fan, I would definitely sit them down and be confident that they would get something out of this movie, much more so than some of his other films.
That's true.
Just in terms of being accessible to a modern American movie fan. Perfect Blue really is it. And I'm kind of surprised because I fully expected to put Paprika on this list. But revisiting it, Paprika's a good movie, but it's a little flawed to where it didn't wind up on my top 10.
It didn't make my list either. I have a lot of love for Paprika, but it didn't make the huge impact on me that his earlier stuff did.
Yeah, for sure. Great opening credits.
Yes.
Okay, so Ted Sutherland's top three, reader Ted Sutherland, or listener Ted Sutherland. Number one, Pat Labor. Number two, Macross Frontier. Number three, Cardcaptor Sakura.
Macross Frontier and then Cardcaptor Sakura. That is an abrupt change.
Yeah, it's a pretty big shift. I have not seen Macross Frontier, but I hear it's pretty good.
Yeah, same here.
But Pat, I don't know what he means by Pat Labor. Maybe he means the movie, TV. I don't know. It doesn't say. Mm. But I very briefly considered Cardcaptor Sakura because I did enjoy that show. But not enough. I think it would be in my top 30.
I liked it, but I burned out on it pretty quick.
Yeah, I don't think I ever got all the way through the TV show.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Okay, so your number five.
My number five actually is Pat Labor 2, the movie.
Really? That low? I would expect that to be in the top three for you.
I did two. I might... Maybe I should have reshuffled these a bit, to be honest.
Well, hey, these lists are not, you know, when I was making this, I'm like, I could really switch these around in any order.
Yeah. In fact, I almost resent having to put them in an order.
Yeah. But hey, lists are fun.
It will change depending on my mood.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. So, you know, these are fluid, but we do it for fun. It's not like this is a rigid hard, you know, like, but whatever. Right. Anyway, so Pat Labor 2.
Pat Labor 2, I've talked about this at length before, so I'll keep it short. Basically, this is the movie you watch when you feel that the world is starting to spin itself apart. That's happening a lot lately.
Yeah.
And it's so thoughtful and thought-provoking. And I genuinely like Captain Goto, the lead, who's just the guy that's kind of caught in the middle and is smart enough to do something about it, however insignificant. Just brilliant work. I think it's Oshii's best film.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't seen it when we had started taping this show. Well, not this show, but doing the podcast.
Right.
And you gave it to me, and I watched it for the podcast. And I have since watched it about three times.
Wow.
I really like that movie. That doesn't happen too often. It's not on my list. But it was one of those number 11 choices. That sequence on the boat where they're just where the dude's giving his monologue. And the music and everything, it's perfect. Like, it's fucking perfect. There's a lot of perfect things about that movie. It's really,
it really
good.
Is true. By the way, as an aside, a few years ago, Kenji Kawai did a concert where he performed a lot of his best-known songs with a full symphony orchestra and the entire Ghost in the Shell chorus of women in yukatas.
Oh, really?
And he opened with that song.
Really? That's cool.
And it's just seen live. If it's up on YouTube, probably illicitly. But if you can track down the Region 2 DVD, I would totally get it. This concert is just mind-blowing. And Kenji Kawai, I mean, I would have paid so much money to be at this concert. And then you hear the, you know, piddly, restrained Japanese applause at the end of these giant show-stopping numbers. You just get so pissed off. You're like, oh, come on, you people should be, like, jumping out of your seats.
Oh, wow. But anyway, yeah, Pat Labor 2 must see for any serious anime fan. Absolutely.
What's your number five?
My number five, Fullmetal Alchemist TV, first one.
Ooh, yeah, that was one of my number 11s.
Yeah, you know what makes that show for me? And again, revisited it. Man, I really rewatched a lot of shit for this. Because it had been forever. I hadn't watched the original Fullmetal Alchemist since I worked at Anime Insider 7 years ago at this point.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, but I really remember loving the crap out of that show. Why did I love that show so much? Roy Mustang makes that whole show for me. His character arc makes that show.
He is awesome.
Well, just in specifically what happens to him, the shit he has to deal with, the themes about, you know, atrocity and wartime and stuff. I mean, this is Seiji Mizushima. You know, it's familiar ground for him. But it's really well executed and really fascinating. And, you know, everybody, this show is super popular. Everybody kind of loves it. And I feel like, you know, to come at it from an angle other than, wow, it sure is a good show. I think Roy Mustang is the reason I love that show so much. Just his character arc. The rest of the show is great, but that part is really special for me. I really loved it. And I think it's part of the reason I haven't really gotten into Brotherhood, just because, well, I saw this first one and I like that. So that's it, you know.
there's a sense of camaraderie and family I get from Full Metal Alchemist that it's really rare. It's very seldom I get that from any fictional work. The interplay between the brothers, obviously, and Winry, and Winry's grandmother, and then later that kind of gets branched off into their friends, you know, be it Roy Mustang or Hughes. You feel with that the character has kind of become part of your extended family.
What I think it is that there's a human warmth to these characters, which is not common in anime. A lot of them are just very cold stereotypes. But in this show, these are fleshed out, flawed human characters that have meaningful connections with each other. It's not just two girls are in love with a guy or whatever. These feel like people. And that's really, really rare. And I think it was done best in that first show. It's a modern classic, I would say.
I agree.
Definitely one of the best. Okay. Kusanagi 08, top three anime movies, or OVAs. Oh, I guess he split this up into movies and series. Well, I'll just read his top three movies. Number one, Millennium Actress. Number two, Pat Labor 2. Number three, Girl Who Leapt Through Time.
Good taste.
Yeah, good taste. Girl Who Leapt Through Time, I didn't like it as much as everybody else did, I don't think. I enjoyed it, but that third act just derails completely.
It does. That's one of those where you love the characters so much, all of the flaws you might be able to overlook depending on how much
you're
connected to the characters.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Okay, all right. And so that brings us to your number four.
My number four is one that almost nobody has seen, and that pisses me off because it's really old and old-looking. It is Touch.
Oh, right. How many episodes is that?
Oh, God. I think it's like hovers around the 100 mark.
So really old, 100 episodes, as inaccessible as you could possibly be. And it's about baseball.
Right.
Well, sort of. It's not really about baseball. But yeah.
It's about baseball.
Really? Okay, so I've never seen Touch.
There are whole arcs that aren't just nothing but watching a baseball game.
Oh, okay. So does this fall into your big wind-up sort of...
Yes, no. I mean, there's obviously a lot more to it than baseball. It's a very human story. There's other sports involved. It's about, you know, it is all-encompassing about the lives of its young protagonists, but they happen to be jocks.
Right.
So that is their life. What makes Full Metal Alchemist great is also what makes Touch great. Really human, really, you know, flawed, but genuinely likable characters. And there are some transformations that happen in Touch that are really mirror what a lot of kids go through during adolescence and, you know, the whole act of finding themselves. And there's, of course, the seminal part of Touch is that a major tragedy happens at literally at the end of the first season that more or less changes the entire trajectory of the show. But it's, you know, Tetsuo Adachi stuff, he has one really, really great story in him. And everything he makes is pretty much different versions of that story, even down to the character design.
He did, like, Cross Game, too, right?
Yeah, Cross Game is his newest, but there's also H2, there's also Hiatari Ryoko.
So the same thing.
More or less.
Yeah.
That said, I think Touch is by far the best of them. Although, Cross Game is really good, so I do recommend that, too.
Yeah, no, I read the first, I got that omnibus of Cross Game, and it's very compelling.
Yeah.
I think... It's one of those situations where Touch is old and hard to get your hands on, and so Cross Game feels like something I'll probably read that.
Yeah, the thing about Touch is that it's, I think, one of the only truly great adult mature anime that really totally captured Japan's psyche for whatever reason.
Really? Okay.
I mean, it was one of those shows in the early 80s, you know, back then before cable, when everyone was actually watching the same thing on television. It was one of those everyone tunes in at the same time to watch this shows.
Oh, kind of like a mash.
Yeah, exactly.
We've got 80 million people watching it or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could go up to any stranger on the street in Tokyo and, you know, strike up a conversation, you'd ask about, they'd ask what your favorite anime are, just trying to make small talk, and you'd mention touching the girl. Oh, Minami was so cute.
Right. So it was really a cultural milestone at the time.
It really was. And, you know, it hit home for all those people for a reason.
Yeah, and so this is very difficult to find, I would imagine, outside of illegal sources.
They are your only hope.
Right, okay. Interesting. Touch. Okay, wow. Not expecting to see that one. That's a surprise.
What's your number four?
My number four, Fooly Cooly. Pretty easy choice there. Pretty obvious choice. But God, what a show. So good. Start just so entertaining. And again, this I connect this one to Interstellar when anime was almost really cool. You know, like for a brief flicker of time there, it's like celebrities gave a shit, and you know, it was the thing, and people ate that up on Cartoon Network, which ran it ad nauseum for like 3 years, just nonstop with that, and it's just so good start to finish. Like, not a single I think it's pretty much flawless in terms of execution, especially the ending. Really great shit.
It is big, stupid grin plastered on your face from start to finish.
Well, yeah, and I think it has some nice things to say about coming of age. I think it's kind of a cool take on a coming of age story, and one of the few totally original stories I've seen animated where they pulled it off, and I think the 6-episode format really worked, like helped it, because there's not an ounce of fat on it. There's no filler. They're never wasting time. They get straight to the end of it, and there's no more, which is even better. There's no sequels or anything. It's a solid one-off, one monolithic thing. And it works. Totally works. And I can't wait to get the Blu-ray, even though I'm sure it won't look that great.
Yeah, it was digital, right? So it had to be an upscale.
2000, so.
Yeah upscale.
Right. All right. Okay. Do you have any particular love in your heart? It sounds like no.
Honestly, I never really connected to the show.
Really? Was it just too out there?
I think so.
Too Gainax-y?
Yeah, it's a little too loud, boisterous, and for some reason, whenever Gainax gets loud and boisterous, I tune out, and I don't know why.
You're not a fan of spectacle, I don't think. And Fooly Cooly is spectacle, and I like that kind of thing. So,
I mean, I appreciate spectacle in service of something, but I don't know. If you spend too much time on the spectacle, I kind of lose interest, I guess.
One of the other things I will say about Fooly Cooly is, at the time, it was cutting edge visually. It still is. 10 years later, it still looks like something you could see in an art installation. It's still really cutting edge.
It is a really good looking show. Yeah, always has been.
Totally, totally. So yeah, that's up there, number four. I was surprised. I didn't even look at the bottom five for that. The minute it popped into my head, I'm like, oh, this has got to be at the top. Okay. So Thomas Zoth's top three anime, number one, Pat Labor 2. Number two, Redline. I think he may have just seen this. And
that sounds like freshly viewed exuberance to me.
Yeah, yeah. Which I haven't seen Redline yet. You did, but we'll talk about that on a later podcast. Okay. And number three, Akira, which almost made my list. Very close. Came close. Almost.
I love Akira, but I don't love it that much.
I love it more now than I did when I first saw it. Now I think
it makes sense now that you've seen the comic.
No, actually, I've never read the comics.
Sense now that it has a watchable dub?
It makes sense now that the translation bothers to explain things.
Right.
The retranslation of it that Jenny On did helped that movie by leaps and bounds. And now I don't find it confusing or anything.
That's true.
Yeah, it's a solid movie. Classic for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which brings us to, we're getting into the end here. Number three. You're number three.
My number three, we are expressly prohibited from talking about at length, Evangelion.
That's my number three, too.
Woohoo! Okay, number twos.
Well, specifically, I want to point out, at this point, Evangelion, I can't divorce it from End of Evangelion, and so my number three is both of them. The TV series and End of Evangelion as one thing.
Yeah, that's how I think of them as well.
Yeah, I don't divorce the TV series from the movie anymore, and we've talked about Evangelion too much on this show in the last couple weeks. So there you go, number three for both of us. That may be our lone our lone point of the only place our paths cross. But
on this list, at least.
On this list, maybe. I don't know. I'm really curious about the other ones. Okay, so let's go ahead and let me read one more reader list. Favorite anime from Johanna Rogers. Number one, Bakano. Number two, Tatami Galaxy. Number three, Paranoia Agent.
Oh, I need to see Tatami Galaxy.
Yeah, that's on my pile of shame, for sure.
Yeah.
But Paranoia Agent almost made my list, too. Very close.
Paranoia Agent is a show that I really have a lot of respect for, but the abrupt shifts in tone and kind of meandering narrative thread really kind of prohibit me from appreciating it as much as I feel I should.
Well, it's like every episode has a different idea about what it is and what it's going to be.
Right.
So it's a you're right, it's a choppy experience. I would, if I had a top 20, it'd be in there.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah. And best, one of the best opening sequences in anime history, though.
Oh, for sure. Oh yeah, I love that. That's awesome. Okay, drum roll, your number two.
My number two, Millennium Actress.
Millennium Actress. That's not number one. Okay, now I'm curious. I expected that to be your number one.
No, Millennium Actress, it's the only Satoshi Kon on my list, although now that we've talked about Perfect Blue, I'm filled with a little bit of regret on that one. Millennium Actress, I've talked about this at length before, but it's quite simply the perfect story about the past for me. It's wistful without... while acknowledging the embellishment of nostalgia. It's smart about its characters. It knows so much more than it's letting on and about. And the more you analyze it, the more interesting it is, I think. Not to mention, invented a whole new way of telling a story that only works with animation.
For sure.
How often does that happen?
Yeah, God, I can't even... Like, that's one of those movies where you watch it and you realize... There are lots of things that you can only do in animation.
Yeah.
And Cohen was just a master of pointing that out. Like, hey, you couldn't make this as a live-action movie, and if you did, it would look like shit.
If there's a single achievement in Cohen's career I can point to that proves, just beyond a shadow of a doubt, the breadth of the man's genius, it's this film.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I mean, in terms of a list of personal favorites, I've seen that one less than I have his other films. Because it's so deep, and it... requires your full attention. You really can't look away from that thing once it starts. And
yeah, it really is absorbing. God, I do wish it had a serviceable dub.
Yeah, you know what? That's one of those where all the characters are Japanese. It's a very Japanese film. It's about Japanese people and Japanese everything. So I wouldn't want to see it in English, I don't think. But yeah.
It makes it easier to show people.
That is true.
And there is a dub. It's by Manga UK, and it's terrible.
Naturally.
It is so flat and shitty, it just kind of fills me with anger.
Yeah. Well, and that DVD, you can still find it. You can't get it cheap. It's like $20 average, yeah. I think. Which is the same for Princess Mononoke. Not a cheap DVD.
The prices went way up after Cohn died.
Yeah. Well, that is true. Interesting. Yeah. Millennium Actress. I'm surprised that is not your number one. Now I'm really curious.
Yeah, what's your number two?
My number two, Nausicaä of the Valley of Wind.
Mm. Blu-ray coming soon, must have.
I have it. I imported it. I couldn't resist. I love this movie so much. It's part of what made me an anime fan. Not the first Miyazaki I saw, but... And I acknowledge the comics are much better. Much better than the film. And the film is a very truncated version of the first, like, bit of the... Like, the first, like, two volumes of the comics. But that movie, it's so classic. It feels like it was dug up from the earth. You know, it's got that 70s, sort of early 80s vibe to it. I love the way it looks. I love the characters. The story's great. I don't know. It's one of those things that's just, it feels like it's part of my soul, you know?
It is your childhood blankie.
Yeah. Yes. I do watch it when I'm sick sometimes. But I know a lot of people think it is flawed. It's not a perfect film. It's certainly probably not his best film, but it is my absolute all-time favorite. And I couldn't. It was either going to be number one or number two. The minute the idea of even doing these lists came into my head, it's like, well, now it's going to be number one or number two. But it's not my favorite.
I think that was actually my first anime.
Your very first.
Well, Warriors of the Wind. My uncle taped it off HBO. in like 86 or so, and I watched it at his house because he was the first person I knew with a giant rear projection 40-inch TV.
Right. Yeah, no, I was first exposed to it as part of a Miyazaki Ghibli marathon at my anime club in the late 90s, and they had a really bizarre schedule where they showed, it was like Kiki's, and then Porco Rosso, and then Only Yesterday, and then Whispers of the Heart, and then this, and then Nausicaa. And Nausicaa was the one that I said, oh, shit. After sitting through all those other movies, Nausicaa was the one where I was like, oh, my God, this is incredible. And then reading the comics later, the two experiences are sort of intertwined. But if you haven't read the comics, I don't know if you have or not. They're really good.
They've been on my shelf for over a decade, but they're the old flopped Viz editions that are kind of, you know, very, very contrasty.
Yeah, yeah. No, if you can track them down, get the big ones they released, the big 11x17 size, because Miyazaki's artwork is really detailed. And there's a lot of
really hard to read.
Oh, totally. They really cram the text into those bubbles. So if you can find the big ones, it's totally worth getting. But I would put that series, those four volumes or those seven volumes, if you get the more cut up one, I would put it up there as a work of seminal epic fantasy storytelling, up there with like Lord of the Rings, easily.
I'm gonna have to rebuy that.
Yeah, it's really good. Okay, so more reader list. Okay, from Chrono the Sinner, his top three anime: number one, Hi Bonnie Renmei; number two, Paranoia Agent; number three, Gankutsuo, Count of Monte Cristo.
Also a great list. Hi Bonnie Renmei is one of the great underloved classics, I think.
Yeah, well, it you know, the people who love it love it, and the people who don't love it either haven't seen it or haven't heard of it. It seems like, which right. is a lot of folks. It was really underexposed.
It was during, I think, the beginning of Genion's implosion, when they kind of lost the ability to really effectively market things.
Right.
This was never going to be a big hit either, because it's very weird and kind of slow.
It is pretty slow.
But, oh my God, it is just so beautiful.
Yeah, and the story's really cool. Like, it's just got a neat concept, cool story. I think the part of the problem is you really can't market it at all. There's no trailer you can cut where it's going to be like, check out this slam bang, whatever. It's all teacups and angel wings and quiet moments and overcast skies and shit. It's very subdued. So it's one of those shows you discover. It's not something that gets slammed into your face.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, and the moment has finally come. Your number one anime of all time.
My number one anime of all time, Only Yesterday.
Okay, shocker. It was either going to be that or Millennium Actress.
Yeah,
Only
seriously.
Yesterday.
I mean, I've written about this stuff how much?
Yeah, a lot.
This movie has moved me immensely, selled my soul when, you know, it lay bleeding at the feet of, you know, broken dreams. This movie has really changed my life in a way that few movies are capable of.
Changed your life, really?
Absolutely. It has forced reexamining of my aspirations, of what I want out of life, of my priorities. It is a positive think about what you really want, sort of. It's basically a loving grandmother that you go to after your life has crushed you.
Wow. Okay.
Yes. This is that movie for me.
I mean, it's pure nostalgia. The whole movie is soaked in nostalgia, which is great. I'm not saying that's bad.
Well, it's bitter nostalgia.
It is.
It's not a, oh, the past was so glorious sort of thing. It's more of a, that was weird. I wonder why that happened. Sort of nostalgia.
For sure. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's measured. And it's adult. It's very adult. Matter of fact, that's one of those movies I would point to and say, like, here, this is a mature film.
And not
mature for any of the reasons people, like, on a video game label, it says mature.
Right.
they don't mean mature. No,
that would be Orochi Doji.
Yeah, right. No, that Only Yesterday, was that a commercial success?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. It's Takahata, right?
Right, yeah. It's easily his best work. I know you're not a huge Takahata fan, but I am.
I need to revisit his stuff. Now that I'm in my 30s, I need to look at his stuff again. Because I haven't seen it since I was 23. So
every single one of his movies makes me sob like a little girl being stepped on.
But yeah, no, I definitely need to revisit all of his stuff. So Only Yesterday, number one, really. This was a no-brainer for you?
Absolute no-brainer.
Like, automatically shot to the top?
That's interesting. Automatic. I think it was literally the first thing I wrote when I sat down to write the list.
Right, you get the easy one out of the way.
Yep. what's your number? And time for your big number one?
Okay, Revolutionary Girl Lieutenant, the movie and the TV series together.
Nice.
Can't really describe how much I love this. It is almost everything I love about art in a show. It is silly and over the top and beautiful and meaningful and has a lot to say and has great characters. And I love this. There isn't anything about it I don't love. And if I had to pick between the TV series and the movie, I really love that movie a lot. Like, to a ridiculous extent. I've seen it easily 20 times. Love that movie. It condenses it down. It's beautiful. And I love the fact that it becomes kind of a parody of allegory at the end. Especially with the whole car wash thing. I mean, brilliant. It is brilliant. It's satire almost at the end. And I love that. It's satire and it still means something. You know? It's just perfect. In my opinion, it is a brilliant piece of art that is also pop and fun and cool and just easily the best piece of anime. Easily the best anime I've ever seen. Easily. Like, I didn't really even have to think twice about this. It gave me an excuse to rewatch the whole thing.
If Ikuhara never makes another anime in his life in the way he's going, that might indeed be the case. I think he can quite happily rest on his laurels with this one.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. I think this is probably... I mean, it's clear he was working every creative muscle he had, turning this thing out. If you look at the comics, it's based on the comics feel totally not inconsequential compared to the show. The TV series has a lot of filler in it, and it's kind of badly animated, which is why I say, like, I kind of prefer the movie, just because it really does realize the beauty of those character designs, and it's fully animated, and those musical sequences are brilliant. It's just a great piece of animation. I don't know, and it not only that, like, I remember watching the end of the TV series, and it was right when I was it was like my first year of college. And I really connected with the notion of becoming your own person and escaping the things that keep you sort of shackled to your personality. That really meant a lot to me at the time, and it still resonates.
Yeah, that is an extremely powerful theme. One thing that I think bears examination is the bizarre Caesar's choruses.
Yeah, those get kind of old, and they are filling time.
Yeah, they're quite clearly filling time. Ikuhara never really gave a good explanation as to why they're in there.
Yeah, I mean, the lyrics are all kind of nonsensical, but I sort of tie that in with the notion that the show is clearly playing on concepts of modern art. And those weird Greek choruses that have a little bit of meaning in them, if you read them, you can kind of tell what they're sort of going for, but it's clearly abstract. And that sort of abstractness of it is definitely part of the appeal for me, because I love that kind of thing.
This show made me really wish I was around in the 70s in Tokyo for their giant explosion of experimental theater.
Yeah.
Because that's where all this weirdness comes from.
Right.
And I was just like, I wish I could get all of the references I'm missing from this.
Yeah, that's the one thing. I'm pretty certain I'm missing a lot. But I'm getting what I want out of it. And so that's I'm getting enough out of it to call it the best anime I've ever seen.
So. And Ikuhara's in the chorus, by the way.
Yeah, I know that.
Okay. Well, you know that. I don't think I read your
stuff. Right, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay, so that's our number ones. Let me read one last reader list for their top anime of all time. Blood Minus from the forums. Number one, Time of Eve, which I've never seen, but I've heard is great.
It is very good.
Number two, Paranoia Agent. And number three, 5 centimeters per second. I have to admit, I almost put Shinkai movies on my bottom.
I am not... I appreciate close. Shinkai movies, but they're all the same, and they're all very simple.
Yeah, Yeah, but anyway, 5 centimeters per second. A lot of people love that movie, and that's his number three.
It is very pretty.
Okay, so now that we're through our top 10 anime of all time, now we're going to get into our bottom 10 movies of all time. The worst movies we've ever seen.
God, this list was almost impossible for me.
Yeah, well, you're not quite the cinematic masochist I am.
No, I am not, and I'm quite happy about that.
Not anywhere near, as a matter of fact.
I have a really, really low tolerance for bad, not unintentionally funny movies. To the point where, like, I kind of get this mental dry heave, and I have to stop watching.
So this list must have been really difficult for you.
It was so hard. I had to, like, dig really deep into my past to remember some of the real crap in my history. But I came up with 10. We'll see.
Okay, well then let's get started. Your number 10, or number 10 worst movie ever.
My number 10 worst movie ever, and I'm going to get so much shit for this, because this movie has a lot of fans, Mars Attacks.
Really? Mars Attacks? It's not
this
that bad.
This was the first film I ever walked out of.
You're shitting me. You walked out of it? Really? Wasn't that bad.
Like 10 minutes before the end.
Yeah. You know what? I've got a Tim Burton on mine, too, so we're not too far apart, you and I, but...
Excellent. yeah, this was just... I didn't care. I didn't care. I didn't care. All of the characters were annoying. The aliens were stupid. I don't need movies to make sense or even have a point. I just need it to give me something I can enjoy about them. And this movie was just joyless flailing. And I just wanted to just stab people afterwards.
Well, you did walk out.
Right.
That is a strong statement to make for Mars Attacks.
The funny part was I went to see this with my family. Mm-hmm. And
oh, you walked out anyway. Okay.
Well, yeah, I just waited for them in the lobby.
Right.
But Robin loved it,
mm-hmm.
and she was so appalled that I hated it that much that she basically goofed on me nonstop, like even to the point of yelling at me constantly from her room for the next 4 hours straight.
I mean, I've seen it relatively recently, a couple of years ago, and it's kind of a failed experiment. I got what he was going for, but the movie is about an hour longer than it needs to be. It's more of a fun concept than a movie. I get what he was going for, though. Number 10, Delgo. Easy choice. Had to be on the list somewhere, but it is number 10. Terrible fucking movie. Dude had $40 million and no one telling him no, and made a movie. And it's this really, really shitty fantasy thing where... It's like if a 15-year-old could just make a movie and throw in every single bad idea he's ever had into one movie. That's what Delgo is. You can rent it, and I think it was on Netflix streaming for a little while, but the animation looks like PS2-era cutscenes with really awful character animation. Also, sadly, the final performance of Anne Bancroft is this movie. Kind of like Orson Welles in Transformers, the animated movie. But yeah, big pile of shit, and not fun, not in a fun way. And there's a wacky sidekick Jar Jar Binks type character played by oh god, what's his face? Corky Romano, that guy.
Oh god,
SNL, goddamn Mango, I can't remember his name.
I can picture his face.
You know who I'm talking about?
Yes,
him. Yeah, really fucking terrible start to finish, and it's funny because. Like, teenagers have all these really bad ideas for, like, fantasy novels and comics that they're going to write. This is one of those brought to life. And it's just hideous. Absolutely hideous. And boring, too, which is one of the worst things you can really perpetrate on people. Is you're trying to make a big, like, action spectacle, and it's just fucking boring.
Doesn't this movie have a record for worst per-screen average ever?
Yes. I believe its opening screen average was $30. Lowest,
like,
yeah, opened
2000
on like
2,000 screens.
Yeah, opened on 2,000 screens. Per screen average was like $30.
Oh my god!
Worst opening in history, I think, for that size budget. But yes, Delgo, Run out and rent it if you really want to see the dregs. They're the worst of the worst. Okay, and our bottom three, first list, bottom three movies from Keonan, one of our forum moderators. Number one, Battlefield Earth. Number two, The Good Shepherd. Kind of surprised that's on there. And number three, Alien Resurrection, which I am one of the few people in the world that will admit to enjoying Alien Resurrection. But
I saw Alien Resurrection. I didn't think it was great, but I didn't hate it.
It's a not great entry in a series that has two great movies in it.
Right. I mean, it is a big decline.
Yeah, it was a big decline. It's very genre-y and doesn't feel like it has anything new to add. It gets a little silly, but I thought it was entertaining. But I like those alien creatures anyway, so I'm kind of a sucker for that sort of thing. Okay. All right, so your number nine, worst movie.
My number nine worst movie, the second movie I ever walked out of.
Okay.
Double Jeopardy.
Okay, remind me what this was.
This had
Ashley Judd.
Ashley Judd and what's his name? The old guy.
Morgan Freeman, was he in it?
No. The old guy from Men in Black.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones. And it was based around the incredibly flimsy premise that actually based around a misunderstanding of the law that you can't be charged for the same crime twice.
Yeah.
So basically the whole flimsy plot is Tommy Lee Jones' character goes to jail for murdering someone that he didn't actually murder, so he breaks out and tries to actually murder her because he can actually get away with it this time.
That movie seems like it was made for, like, straight to Lifetime.
Oh, it was just heinous. Well, the most insulting thing about it, though, was I was living in the dorms when it came out, and I was getting screeners from Central Park Media, and they were doing those awful Asian pulp cinema movies at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just sent me a screener that I had just watched of this terrible chicks in prison exploitation movie set in America called Scorpion's Revenge, Sasori in USA.
Okay.
And it was almost the exact same plot, without the misunderstanding of the law, and was just so much sillier that it actually made the concept kind of amusing.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I walked out of this movie going, oh my god, the shitty Japanese exploitation movie did this better.
You know, the worst thing about Double Jeopardy was that it was a big hit, and it led to this string of crappy Ashley Judd, like, mid-range, you know, movies based on, like, forgettable mystery throwaway novels. There was a series of them, and yeah, it sort of ran aground Ashley Judd's career.
Yeah, indeed. So what's your number number nine?
Number nine, Battlefield Earth, which is kind of a cheat, because Battlefield Earth is right on the cusp of so bad it's fun. But it's so incompetent, from frame one to the last frame, that you cannot overstate. You cannot overstate how ludicrously terrible Battlefield Earth is. I walked out of it. And then rented it. Because
there's so something wrong with you.
Well, because at the time I was in college and I was like, nobody believed me. I was like, Battlefield Earth is like the worst fucking movie ever made. And they're like, it's not that bad. It can't be that bad. I'm like, oh yeah? Well, we're going to watch this shit. And it only got worse. Like, I walked out. There's a moment where John Travolta in his big, like, drag queen boots and dreads leads a group of man animals out to this pasture. And he has this, like, crappy, like, laser pistol. And he's, like, teaching them how to hunt, and he shoots a cow, and he blows the cow's leg off. And the special effects were so shitty that it looks like they just, like, had, like, a fake cow leg and just threw it into the air. And I look over at my friend who I was with, and I was like, we gotta go. We have to get out of here. So we left, and then from then on, like, the climax of the film is these cavemen suddenly learning how to fly F-15s, and they blow up the planet Cyclo. Oh, God, it's such a bad movie. But the weird thing about it is every single shot in that movie, almost every single shot, is shot at this weird tilted angle, and it'll tilt left to right based on who the camera is focusing on. So you'll have a conversation between two people. It'll be tilt left, cut to the other guy, tilt right, and it's all on this weird diagonal axis. And it's totally incompetent. No one would ever look at that and go, oh, this is a great creative choice. Like, it cannot be overstated. And this movie's on, like, everyone's top 10 worst movies. But it belongs there for a reason. Because it really is, like, just a gigantic fiasco.
Wow.
Well, and probably the only film on this list where it's like, if you think you've seen the worst movie and you haven't seen Battlefield Earth, you need to see it because it will restructure what you think of as a bad movie.
Is this worth watching with the riff tracks?
It's worth watching without the riff tracks. I would say riff tracks doesn't make the movie any funnier than it already is.
Wow.
Like, it's that. That's why I said it's kind of a cheat, because I know I said I wouldn't put anything on it. It's so bad it's good. But it's only if you have... I think it's extra funny if you have a basic knowledge of how to put a film together. Just a giant mess. Okay. From Kyokun703, her bottom three movies. Problem Child. Remember the cartoon Problem Child?
Oh, God.
It's on Hulu. Twilight, which I wouldn't put Twilight on a Borscht movies list. And Battlefield Earth. So there you go.
Awesome.
Okay, and let's go ahead and say your number 8.
I have to preface this by saying that I barely even remember seeing this movie.
Okay.
The Jackal.
The Jackal. This was with Bruce Willis.
Yes.
Okay.
It was a completely forgettable, just boring hunt-down terrorist movie.
Uh-huh.
But just to give him some kind of character, they made him gay.
Really?
Yeah.
He was gay in that movie? I don't remember that.
Yeah, just out of nowhere, he just goes into a bar and starts making out with a dude.
That sounds hilarious, though.
Well, it was just so out of character, and it was so obviously aiming at middle America homophobia button pushing.
Uh-huh.
That I just found it, that just kind of stuck with me. I'm like, wow, that is utterly repugnant.
Let's freak out the squares, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's literally the only thing I remember about that movie. Bruce Willis makes out with a dude.
That's definitely memorable. I didn't know that. I had completely avoided that. It looked super generic.
It was indeed super generic, except for Bruce Willis making out with a dude.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay.
What's your number 4?
My number 8.
Or number 8, sorry.
My number 8, Martin Brest's much maligned, gigantic fucking clusterfuck, Geely. I saw it in the theater, specifically because everyone said it's the worst fucking thing ever made. And it's pretty close. It's pretty close. It's unwatchable. Like, it's really hard to sit through. Because it's so bad. And it's all the dialogue. Dialogue's terrible. Story's awful. It's Jennifer Lopez, and this famously ruined the whole Bennifer thing back in the late early part of the decade. They're playing hitman. She's a lesbian, but turns for him. They have to take care of this mentally challenged kid. And they have to, like, cut off his thumb. And the mentally challenged kid really wants to go to the set of Baywatch, which he keeps calling the Baywatch. Al Pacino shows up at one point and just eats this. Like, he may as well just start gnawing on a couch. Like, literally, self-parody Al Pacino performance. But you can't really describe how bad this movie is without mentioning the dialogue. And I don't want to repeat any of the dialogue because it's ear poison. I mean, I intentionally sought this movie out. And it's one of those where everyone goes, oh, my God, this is the worst. What a giant bomb. I can't believe how bad it is. And you go, there's no way it's that bad. And then you walk out of the theater with post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, it's just a nightmare. And it belongs on pretty much, I would say belongs on almost every modern top 10, bottom 10 worst movies list. Just wow. Absolutely hideous. From start to finish, definitely a deserved reputation. Okay, and our bottom three from BTA Takeo. Okay, so here we go. His bottom three, Man of the Hands of Fate, Creeping Terror, Space Mutiny. All right, Mystery Science Theater, gotcha.
Right. Space Mutiny is awesome with Mystery Science Theater.
I was about to say, that's like the second or third best episode of Mystery Science Theater.
Well, yeah, I mean, that and Pod People, I think, are my two favorites.
Mm. I still go with Werewolf and Puma Man, I think.
Puma Man's great.
Puma Man's fucking awesome. Okay, your number 7.
My number 7, I have to say I only saw this because I had to rent the DVD and rip it to make a stupid little comedic short with a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Basic Instinct 2.
Now, I never saw that, but I heard it was a giant turd. The first one's not great, but...
It's really stupid. Makes absolutely no sense. Sharon Stone, although still attractive... just crosses that line from attractive woman who's being seductive to attractive woman who is just creepy and is clearly wanting to eat you with her vag.
She's a little too old for that, I think, at the point.
She was too old, but just a little.
Yeah.
But she is trying so hard. The script is so stupid. And she thinks that she's way hotter than she is.
Yeah. Well, that whole thing was just a vanity project.
Yeah, more or less.
I think she's,
she's still trying to make Basic Instinct 3.
Yeah, really?
Yes.
I wonder if the second one made money. It must have. Overseas, probably.
Yeah. It's just, nobody was able to tell this woman, look, stop. Nobody wants to see that.
Yeah, never touched that one. Probably never will.
There's a great scene where just for no reason, in a heat of passion, she drives herself and her lover off a dock into a bay and cuts to her just being okay later. And we never find out what happens to the lover.
Nice. Nice.
So you're number 7.
My number 7 will probably be met with some, I don't know, derision or whatever, but I couldn't not have it on here. Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. Surprised that I had it on there myself.
Really?
I fucking hated that movie. Absolutely hated it. I feel like it took a giant steaming dump on the original, on the Disney animated version, on every version that's ever been made beforehand. It had no business being called Alice in Wonderland. It's an ugly mess. The 3D was terrible. And it is the worst kind of generic, let's take these characters from this beloved children's classic and slap them onto the world's most generic fantasy chosen one hero story that you get in every Harry Potter, Percy Jackson, whatever, all of those movies that all kind of have, I mean, Harry Potter's sort of the good one.
Right.
But it's that generic, you know, this magical land needs your help and you're the only person that can save us, you know. That doesn't need to be in a fucking Alice in Wonderland movie.
That sounds just rage-inducing.
Oh, it's absolutely terrible. And I was sitting there, like, fists clenched in the theater because I couldn't believe that this is where they were going to take this. Because they had this wonderful, amazing opportunity to make a big-budget version of Alice in Wonderland. And there are moments in the movie where they flash back to Alice, the original story, because this movie is more of like Alice in Wonderland 2. And they flash back, and the little flashback sequences are like, why didn't you make that movie? Because it looks great. But then it's back to this shitty fucking, oh god, I hated it so much. Notably, Tim Burton is the only director that is represented on both my best and worst movie lists. and this was the one. I thought it was much worse than any of his other train wrecks, because he's made some bad shit since the 90s. But this is the worst. This is the worst one. Notably, the thing that makes you that turns this movie from really bad to absolutely fucking terrible, there's a dance sequence at the end that the Mad Hatter does that is so out of place and so hideous and so insulting and so awful. And you can look it up on YouTube, just that one scene, because it's so bad. I was seeing red. I was so angry.
Jeez. This movie.
Absolutely hated it. I couldn't. I'm surprised it's not higher on my list. I would have put it higher. Totally just pain. Okay. Bottom 3 movies from Super Deformed. Let's see here. Number 1, Mission to Mars. Good choice. Terrible movie.
Never saw that.
I saw it in the theater. Number 2, Day After Tomorrow. Yeah, okay. Pretty standard disaster movie.
Yep.
And he put number 3, Some Sarah Jessica Christmas Movie with Owen Wilson. I don't know what he's referring to there, but sound great.
No.
Okay. All right. Moving on. You're number 6.
My number 6, Transformers 2.
And now I'm happy that that's on your list, because you were like, when you saw it, you were like, meh. And I was like, no, it was terrible. And you're like, meh.
Yeah, well, I don't know. For some reason, it's like when you're shot, you don't feel it right away. It just burns a little.
Yeah,
that's what Transformers 2 was to me. It was one of those, like, the more I thought about it, it's just like, wait a minute, this movie did what?
You know, he blames it on the writer's strike. Which,
oh, come on!
Yeah, right, exactly. That's no excuse for having continuity that fucked up.
Continuity's fucked up. Apparently no one on set had smoked weed before. It doesn't turn you into hyperactive Daffy Duck.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus, I forgot about that.
They're just kind of epitomizes the whole flashy CG, we can't really storyboard this effectively, so let's just throw in a lot of edits so everyone gets really confused as to the spatial relations.
That movie is a mess. It's not on my list. It was almost on my list. But it really is just an absolute train wreck. From start, it's kind of like the worst things about American blockbuster tent poles, like all in one.
Yeah, it really is. Your number six.
My number six is this is an obvious choice, but you really can't have a bottom 10 without this on it, and I'm pairing it with another movie in terms of worst superhero movies, Batman and Robin and Spider-Man 3. I'm putting them both as a tie at number six.
Batman and Robin being, of course, the infamous Batman with nipples.
Well, actually, it's, you know, people give Batman Forever a pass because it's not as bad as Batman and Robin, but it's almost as bad. Like, Joel Schumacher didn't make a good Batman movie. He made really shitty, like, he was trying to, like, sort of mix the Tim Burton style with the 60s Batman.
The camp.
Oh, it's fucking horrible. And, you know, the shitty thing is that in both of these movies, he just tells the villain, like, the villains just, like, act like the Joker. Don't act like what you're supposed to act like. Be this wacky, zany, over-the-top, pun-filled character. And they're both horrible. Everybody knows how bad Batman and Robin is. I don't have to go into it. But people also do not give enough credit to how truly terrible Spider-Man 3 is. Spider-Man 3 is awful. It's almost as bad as, like, Batman Forever. I would probably say it's worse than Batman Forever. Total mess of a film. Total mess. Just as clunky and screwed up as really any of these sort of late-period superhero sequels. There's too many villains. The director clearly doesn't care about one of the villains. In Spider-Man 3's case, Venom, who's completely... The characterization's totally fucked up. At one point, Eddie Brock goes into a church and prays to Jesus to kill Spider-Man. Like, this is a fucking... has that emo dance number. I don't know if you ever saw it. But
no.
God, it's horrible. And at the end, it totally destroys Spider-Man's entire reason for existing. Because the setup is the Sandman, played by the guy from Wings. For some reason, I'm blanking on names today. The Sandman killed Uncle Ben. And at the end of the movie, the Sandman confronts Spider-Man and goes, "Oh, sorry about killing your uncle." And Spider-Man goes, "Oh, it's okay." And then the Sandman flies away at the end.
What?
I mean, it's not in those exact words, but that's the gist of it. And it's like, well, we don't need any more of these. He can stop being Spider-Man now. He doesn't need vengeance anymore. Fucking terrible. Just fucking terrible. And people kind of get like, well, it wasn't that great. No, it was awful. Like, go back and watch it again. Watch it and compare it to Spider-Man 2, which was a really good superhero movie.
People said the same thing about Phantom Menace when it first came out.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad. Yeah, watch it now. It's unwatchable.
Yeah. All right. So.
Okay. From Ben Dorton, bottom five, Plan 9 from Outer Space, and then a tie between Troll 2 and The Room. None of which I would put on a bottom 10, especially not Troll 2 or The Room. Those are highly entertaining. And actually, for those people out there, if you've never seen Troll 2, see it and then see the documentary Best Worst Movie, which is really good, which is about the people who are in Troll 2.
Oh, I've heard, I keep meaning to check that out.
It's really good. And it's better if you've seen Troll 2 and understand why it has this giant cult following. Okay, so you're number five.
Number five, I'm embarrassed to say that I saw this at the theater and I might be the only one.
Okay.
Actually, no. I was young enough that I think I dragged my dad to go see it with me.
Okay.
Mannequin 2 on the Moon.
Oh, man. I've seen that. Whoa. Holy shit.
What a stinker. It's just like this insipid 80s fairy tale with... It's like a bad made-for-TV movie. God, adjectives fail me.
Did they do a total cast replacement for that? Wasn't it like
complete.
Judge? Wasn't it was like Judge Reinhold and like someone who wasn't Kim Cattrall, and I can't remember who it was.
No, it was a total restart of the quote unquote franchise. The original had Andrew McCarthy and Kim Cattrall. This one had the guy from Herman's Head.
Classic.
And I forget who the hot girl was.
Forgettable.
Yeah, well, they were all like TV caliber actors.
Yeah.
And the only carryover cast-wise was the flaming guy that gives a big show at the end, which they didn't even have enough money to build a proper set for the big fashion show. those couple cuts had a CG stage.
Yeah.
And it was so obvious and so terrible that I could pick it out. I don't know why I asked to see this movie.
Who knows?
I was really young. I plead ignorance. But yeah, this is... did they even ever bring this out on DVD, I wonder?
I swear I've seen it on DVD somewhere. I know it gets run on deep cable channels every now and then, but wow, that is a good pick. That's a stinker.
Really. You're number five.
My number five, another movie I saw in the theater that is underappreciated how bad it is. Dreamcatcher. This is the Stephen King, based on a Stephen King short story, that I saw because if you remember, leading up to the Matrix sequels, they would release shorts from the Animatrix theatrically in front of other movies, in front of other Warner Brothers movies that they were trying to get nerds to go see. Dreamcatcher had the Square Enix animated one, Final Flight of the Osiris, in front of it. So we all went to go see Dreamcatcher in order to see this Animatrix short, not knowing that one of the worst movies ever was attached to the back end of it.
I haven't even heard of this. Who's in it?
I don't remember who's in it. But Dreamcatcher is about it's got sort of two stories. But the basic thrust of the plot is that an alien species is invading Earth, or somehow, I can't remember if they escaped from a government compound or whatever, but the gist of this alien species is they infect you, you start going crazy, and then you shit out a poop eel, an evil poop eel that explodes from your ass, and then it's literally a moving log of shit that has teeth and eyes. Now, it sounds like, oh, that sounds like a hilarious fun time at the movies. No, it's played totally straight. It is deadly serious from start to finish. The movie ends with Morgan Freeman in a fighter jet shooting aliens in the woods. I can't remember how it gets to that point. There is also a magical autistic guy who I believe his name is Duddits, who turns out to be... It sounds like a hilarious carnival of bad, but it played totally straight, start to finish. Takes itself completely seriously. Just, wow. Oh my god. Yeah, Dreamcatcher. Not a lot of people have seen it, I don't think. It is underappreciated, and how hideous that movie is. And it was a last-minute addition to the list, but once I remembered it, up it went. Straight to number five. From Aaron Dearden, bottom three movies. Number one, Master of Disguise. Number two, Expelled, which I've seen on more than one bottom three list. That's that awful Ben Stein creationist documentary, quote-unquote documentary, where he disproves evolution. And number three, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief.
I saw that, and the most interesting thing about that movie were the guys doing coke in the back row.
It was pretty bad. It wasn't bad enough to be remarkable.
It's a combination of Harry Potter and a JRPG fetch quest.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's really clunky and just kind of badly done.
Yeah.
And that the Pierce Brosnan horse made me laugh.
Yeah, that was funny.
Okay, you're number four.
My number four is a movie that when I was young, I used to love, and then I rewatched it as an adult and went, holy shit. It is the Corey Feldman sequel to the Ramones classic Rock and Roll High School, Rock and Roll High School Forever.
Never saw it. Sounds great.
I watched it because I originally saw it because I was obsessed with the B-movie pay-per-view channel when I was a kid. And this was the only PG movie I think they ever showed.
Really? Okay.
Well, that and the Jay Leno, Pat Morita movie Collision Course.
Right, yeah.
Which was my number 11 on this list, by the way. At any rate, basically, it's you know, these cool high school kids have to rock the system, and you know, they end up burning down the school. Spoiler.
Right.
It's really just this bizarre mishmash of things that they thought were cool but make absolutely no sense. There's the goth girl who is possibly mildly learning disabled, and basically just kind of goons out and freaks out. There's this bizarre scene where they, the gang, Corey Feldman's band, freaks out a local couple by worshiping their old refrigerator.
Ugh. God, it's so painful.
There is a not fully explained and completely nonsensical business slash talent agent being run out of the school, a secret room in the school bathroom. And my personal favorite is they somehow program their synthesizer to spam the local radio station, call in, you know, vote for your favorite local band thing. And not only does the guy from the radio station have access to their phone bill and hands it to them, but the truck that he's in was clearly a PA truck hastily painted with temporary paint.
Sounds great.
Oh, and of course, the classic, you know, the big, you know, electrified fence around the school. They didn't have enough money for a moving fence. So while you hear the fence opening, it just cuts to a shot of the light at the top of the pole.
So it sounds like really shoddily made, every shitty, like, teen movie from the 80s cliche rolled into one.
Yes. It had a decent soundtrack. I'll give it that.
Interesting. Okay.
Your number four?
Don't need to go into this one too much, but it had to be on here, Dragon Ball Evolution. Could not have it on there.
Terrible. Obvious reasons.
Yep, obvious reasons. Read my review if you haven't read it. Okay, I'm not even going to bother. It's probably the worst adaptation I think I've ever seen. Really, really, just completely incompetent from start to finish. Okay, Salvador Asensio's bottom three movies, 10,000 BC, Jumper, and Blades of Glory. Definitely three bad movies. 10,000 BC especially was really bad.
I heard that.
It was like Roland Emmerich just jizzing all over the screen. Okay. All right. Your number, what are we on, three? Your number three. Yep.
My number three is American Idol from Justin DeKelly.
Yeah. Oh, that's a pick.
Yep. I saw this not entirely of my own will, so I have that out. At CPM during lunch hour, we used to have... we used to watch bad movies in the conference room. Mm-hmm. And so we got picks like, you know, Zardoz and, you know, ironic picks like that.
Yeah.
From Justin to Kelly was so bad, I wanted to leave, but kind of felt trapped. I couldn't move. It was just one horribly hammy, terrible, badly acted, mush-mouthed, charisma-free piece of, you know, garbage set piece after another, strung together by quite possibly the lamest musical numbers in cinema history.
Yeah, whenever I hear reviews of this, they always play some clips of just how insipid the lyrics were.
The lyrics? Try the dialogue. Yeah. I mean, literally, it could not get worse if it had a laugh track. It's like that sort of, you know, barely passable in the 1950s sort of banter.
Yeah, no, that's a classic turd, I think. Shows up on a lot of bottom tens.
Boy, and am I happy Justin Guarini is no longer a name spoken.
It's hard to believe that the American Idol is still as relevant today as it ever was, and they shout out that movie.
It's a miracle that didn't just doom the entire franchise right then and there.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, your number three?
My number three is kind of a cheat, but I call it the M. Night Shyamalan trilogy of shit. Last Airbender, Happening, Lady in the Water. I didn't want him to take up three whole spaces on his own, but he kind of deserves to. I cannot believe that these movies were theatrically released, produced. Someone gave him money to make these. I don't know how many of them you've seen.
None, because I read about them.
Yeah, I think the worst one is The Happening. I think so. Not by a considerable margin. There's not a lot of daylight between these three in terms of how bad they are. Last Airbender has been ripped apart by, I think, everyone who's seen it. It's fucking terrible. M. Night Shyamalan, I don't know what happened to him. I used to think he was talented. I don't think he is anymore. Whatever he had in the early part of the decade, he spent all of his creative goodwill on Unbreakable and The Sixth Sense, because everything he's made since then is pretty bad. I thought Signs had its moments. But these three movies are so incompetent, so bad, it's really hard to believe that they would even watch dailies and say, like, oh, let's make this. Let's continue to give you money. Let's keep this in production. Like, I can't believe it. And he's now his name is Mud. So I'm hoping he just, like, I don't know, winds up direct to video or something. I don't know. I don't know how he kept getting work even after The Happening.
I don't know, but Last Airbender was actually, I'm not sure if it made money, but it didn't tank.
It did make money. I looked at the total production budget and the worldwide gross are on Box Office Mojo.
Uh-huh.
And worldwide gross was close to $400 million.
Oh my God.
So we're probably going to get another one, hopefully not a Shyamalan.
God.
But I'm pretty sure they locked him in for like three movies or something. So I just, oh I can't, God. Yeah, Last Airbender was... I mean, any one of these movies, you can point to scenes in them and just go, what the fuck? Who? How did this even get made? You know, fucking Lady in the Water, he casts himself as a messianic writer whose writing is destined to change the world.
His foil is a movie critic.
Yeah, the movie critic that gets eaten alive while criticizing how bad the movie is throughout it. So fucking terrible. God damn it, M. Night Shyamalan. Okay. From Milan... least three least favorite movies: What Lies Beneath, Eye of the Beholder, another Ashley Judd classic, and E.T. the Extraterrestrial. A lot of people hate E.T. now.
I was never really a huge fan. My parents made me. It was one of those. My parents were like, "You should watch this," and I'm like, "I don't get it."
he's a little walking scrotum.
Yeah,
it's uncanny how much like a scrotum he looks.
We're certain old people.
yeah. Right. Okay. Okay, your number two.
My number two, God, it's amazing how many of these I dragged my poor dad to.
A lot of stuff from your childhood.
Yeah. Well, this is one that we still talk about. It was that bad. And it wasn't bad because it was a bad production. It was bad because it was the epitome of lazy cash-in, kids will watch anything bullshit.
Okay.
It was... Heathcliff, the movie.
Oh, shit. Wasn't that Stitched Together episodes?
Yes.
Okay.
And they didn't advertise it as such. And, you know, I was the sort of kid, being a giant nerd, mm-hmm. I insist on sitting through the credits for every movie.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't really hit home with me just how much I had been gypped until we got to the credits, and they were the exact same 30-second TV credits.
You're surprised,
that was
like
how little work they put into this.
Surprised they didn't get squashed into a corner while a local commercial played.
and like we had some family friends over for dinner immediately afterwards, and we got home, and my dad was just like, "I don't know what this was." Like, he'd never heard of Heathcliff before. He called him a second rate Garfield, mm-hmm. which by itself, that's pretty damning praise.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was the biggest, most frustrating waste of time. And I think really opened my dad's eyes to just how shitty children's television really was in the 80s.
Heathcliff the movie. Jesus, that cannot be on DVD.
I don't think it is, actually. But my God, what a fucking heinous piece of work that.
Did that have the Junkyard Cats in it?
Yeah, I think it did.
I can't remember.
I don't honestly remember. the new bookend that they animated was literally, this is how lazy it was. It was Heathcliff telling stories to a bunch of little cats.
Oh, God. Okay. Of course.
just fucking lazy. So you're number two?
My number two, the Dana Carvey classic, The Master of Disguise.
Oh, I saw this one coming.
Still the second worst movie I've ever seen. Cannot believe it. Just pain from start to finish, and that's only 70 minutes. It's 70 minutes, and 10 minutes of that is ending credits.
The trailer for that movie made me flee the room.
Oh, it's so bad. So bad. The villain is Brent Spiner, who farts while he's talking, which that's the joke, and they use it every time he's on screen.
Oh, my God.
And Dana Carvey's character is named Pistachio Disguisey. It's just terrible. Oh my God. It's hard to describe. It is this gigantic abortion of a children's film. Like, it tried to be this big tentpole, like, kind of like late 80s style fantasy, big budget fantasy thing, like a la like The Golden Child or whatever.
It looked like it had some Pee Wee influence.
A little bit of a Pee Wee. Well, they were trying, I think.
Influence, I said, not.
Yeah, I mean, most of it is just an excuse for Dana Carvey to do voices. That's pretty much the entire reason the movie exists, so he can do voices. At the beginning of it, he does a Shrek impression for no reason at all. Oh, The Master of Disguise. It's pure pain. And you know what? Bad comedy is so much worse than any other type of bad movie.
It is.
It really is. It is much more painful to sit through. And we'll get to that with number ones. Okay, so bottom three from Phoenix Fire 24. Number one, Twilight movies. Number two, Last Airbender. Number three, Daredevil. Daredevil was really bad. Terrible movie. Absolutely.
I saw a bit of that with the riff tracks, and I couldn't make it through the movie with the riff tracks.
If the movie's genuinely terrible, riff tracks doesn't really help it that much.
No, it doesn't.
Like, the Twilight movies, are their biggest sin is being boring, and the riff tracks don't really make them not boring. So it's kind of makes it tough. I've sat through all of them anyway. Okay, and your number one worst movie of all time. Let's hear it.
My number one worst movie of all time, Pocket Ninjas.
Pocket Ninjas. Okay, now you've brought this up a few times. Not on the show, but in person, I've heard you talk about Pocket Ninjas.
It is astonishing. Now, this might... I could be a little off here because it's clearly a very low-budget indie movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, it is so barely recognizable as a movie that I'm shocked that anyone has ever been able to do anything with it. But it's gotten several DVD releases, which I can't figure out. Literally, whole action set pieces involve cartoon sound effects while grown men in biker outfits bounce on balloons.
When did this come out?
Late 90s.
So were they trying to get whatever was left of the steam out of the Three Ninjas franchise?
Pretty much.
Because that sounds exactly like what Three Ninjas was, which was dumb, like, little kid ninjas fighting bad guys with cartoon sound effects.
Exactly. Except Three Ninjas, bad as those movies were, had a little bit of entertainment value in them.
Well, they were at least made by somebody who maybe has made a movie before.
Right. Pocket Ninjas was the film school version of Three Ninjas.
Oh, Jesus. Now that's a box quote.
It is heinous. It even has the evil mafia overlord, who's a little Asian boy.
Yeah.
And to fill time, to make it a feature length, there are literally 5-minute practice sequences, which are basically just the kid with two bad guys standing in formation and flailing fake ninja moves.
God.
My favorite part about this whole movie isn't actually in the movie. It's on the IMDb page for the movie, wherein the director pops in to the worst movie ever thread to go, "You guys, you don't know how hard it is to make a movie. We tried really hard." Which, to me, that elevates it to a whole nother plane of awful.
Yeah, when the director gets defensive. That's truly terrible. Oh, Jesus.
So you're number one. I think I already know
what everybody. This is. Well, if you know me, you know what this is, and it hasn't changed in years. It's The Love Guru. And honestly, I always point it out. Like, look, this is the worst movie I've ever seen. It's painful from start to finish. Not a single joke in it works. It's disgusting. It's obviously a really awful vanity project. It's a shitty Mike Myers character that doesn't work. It's heinous, absolutely heinous, and offensively bad, to unwatchable, really. And people don't know that. And I've had people like, "Oh, I saw it." Nah, no. Like, were you high or drunk or asleep? Did you notice how bad this was? Like, it makes me upset. Like, I can't really talk too much about The Love Guru without yelling, because it's so bad. It's so bad. Every single thing about it is terrible. Like, it's, again, bad comedy. Bad comedy is poisonous to the soul and difficult to sit through. And I think the 1-2 punch here is that my number one is Love Guru, number two, Master Disguise, but I was a huge Wayne's World fan when I was a kid. Huge fan of Wayne's World when I was a little kid. Like, really into it. And now it's like, you know, if they got hit by a bus, I would be like, "Well, you did make those movies."
My favorite part about Love Guru is how when it came out, Mike Myers went on this huge press tour, like going on Fresh Air and talking about how this working through this was about his issues with his dad.
Oh, God. And that the movie's mostly just like piss jokes and shit jokes. And it ends with Mike Myers riding an elephant that's fucking another elephant. Just, God damn it.
Maybe his dad was incontinent and she didn't
I have to stop thinking about The Love Guru now. The sequences where Mike Myers is—it's a flashback to his youth—is a kid's body with Mike Myers' adult head awkwardly CG pasted onto it. Oh, fucking god! Ben Kingsley's in it, of course. Because if he's in something, he's not quite at the Malcolm McDowell level of warning, warning, don't watch this movie, but he's getting close.
Seriously.
Anyway, Love Guru, Jesus fucking Christ. And I have yet to see anything that's worse. I really do. And I watch a lot of shitty movies on purpose.
I notice you've curbed the habit lately.
Yeah, well, something has to be truly, like, truly bad. It really has to get down in there. I'm looking forward to seeing that recent Nutcracker, for example.
Man, that has gotten the most savage reviews I've seen in years.
Yeah, totally. Okay, our final bottom list movies from Garth Olamundi from the forums. Mazes and Monsters, which I never saw. Tom Hanks is in that, I think. Life Force and Mamoru Oshii's Talking Head.
Talking Head's pretty self... It's masturbation, the movie.
Right, of course. Sounds like it. Okay, well, that wraps up our first show. We will be back next week with our... part two of our holiday special. Hopefully you'll enjoy that one too, and we'll see you next time. The yummy fruity pebbles in a bowl. Oh, here comes you know who. Yabba dabba fruit, delicious dew. Oh, ho, ho, I'm hungry. Santa, my pebbles. Your pebbles. 'Tis the season to be sharing, Fred. Happy holidays, pal. Oh, Fred. Fruity and Cocoa Pebbles cereals, part of this nutritious breakfast.